not you.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
Missed that detail.
Memo number 46 includes three questions on accounting for pre-production activities. Question one relates to identifying promised goods or services and is applicable to both GAAP and IFRS. Questions two and three relate to U.S. GAAP guidance only. I'm going to tee up question one for discussion, and then after we conclude the discussion of question one, we'll move on to questions two and three. So on question one, some long-term supply arrangements require an entity to undertake efforts in an upfront engineering and design to create new technology or adapt existing technology to the needs of the customer. The pre-production activity is often a prerequisite to delivering any units under the production contract. Stakeholders have raised questions on how to determine when pre-production activities are a promised good or service in a contract with the customer. This question somewhat linked to the discussion from January's TRG meeting, where we discussed the identification of promised goods or services. In that meeting, there was discussion around the guidance in the standard that states that promised goods or services do not include activities that an entity must undertake to fulfill a contract unless those activities transfer a good or service to the customer. The staff's analysis in Memo 46 transfers on transfer of control as a key consideration in determining if the pre-production activities are a promised good or service. That is, if control or the good or service transfers to the customer, then it's likely a promised good or service for purposes of applying step two of the revenue model of identifying performance obligations. Furthermore, this notion is also applicable to determining if pre-production activity should be included in measuring satisfaction of a performance obligation transferred over time. So with that, I'll open it up for discussion by the TRG members in London.
Okay. Any comments here? Bill?
There wasn't anything in this first part that I disagreed with. I think it is focusing on the right sorts of questions. But I do think that this is a particularly difficult aspect of dealing with the standard. And I'm not sure that we've yet got to a place where we're going to see, you know, as much consistency of application as we might like. I think there are probably questions that will still be very difficult to answer based on this. Paragraph 9, I think, is helpful in talking about thinking about whether control of a good or service is ever transferred to a customer. I think in that situation there might be three possibilities. One possibility is yes, it does transfer, in which case yes, it's likely to be part of the activity. If actually at the end of this contract there is still an asset and you're still using it as a seller and therefore control clearly hasn't transferred, I think that strongly suggests that it isn't part of the performance obligation, not part of the activity. Of course, the difficulty is that in many cases it's neither of those two. In many cases it simply doesn't exist anymore by the time you get to the end of the contract. And there I'm not sure that this is particularly going to help one way or the other. Certainly there are a lot of industries where mobilization activities are very significant at the start of a contract, and I believe that there is some diversity in practice at the moment. And I'm not sure that this is going to eliminate that diversity. So I don't disagree with anything, I just think this is a big topic and I'm not sure that we've given all the help we could possibly give yet.
Do you think, I mean, on that question, do you think it's really possible to start giving more help that's going to be useful generally? I mean, you can go down to individual cases all the time.
Not necessarily. I don't know whether it's worth trying to have further discussion about it to see if there are things that can come out. I mean the paper we just finished discussing is equally difficult, and yes, I think some useful thoughts came out of that. So I think it might be possible to do more.
Any other chance?
Ian? To echo a lot of the sentiments that Phil gave, in my outreach around this one, there seems to be a fixation very often on legal title, but when you look at the contract, it's not necessarily, the legal title seems to be more protective than anything else, and you've got to look at a lot more than just what the facts would indicate on the surface of it in the contract. I thought as well, I mean, to me, paragraph 9 was the most helpful in this section. And I think it sets out the way to think about it. I didn't think we needed to go more in depth in this particular issue, but I'll leave that to the staff to decide.
Yeah, much the same. I thought that this aspect of the paper was helpful. There are not going to be straightforward answers to some questions, but I think this gives you the framework for the things that you might want to think about. So is control of this asset ever going to transfer? And if it is, then how am I going to apply the revenue standard? If not, then is it going to fall into the one of the other asset standards, or would I look at it as a fulfillment cost? Would I even look at it as a lease? But I think what the paper does is point out to my mind that there is enough in the standard, and I don't think that this group could ever hope to answer all of the detailed questions. So I think I'd be inclined to say it tells us what the framework is, and let's work with the standard.
Jake.
Thanks, Ian. Similar to what others have said, I think that what's laid out here clearly articulates the principle, which is, are these fulfilment costs transferring a good or service to a customer? But I do think there are going to be areas where judgment is required, and I think that the examples that you give, Phil, are in point, those types of arrangements where actually those fulfilment costs may have no value at the end of the term of an arrangement because they've been used up during that contract, are likely to be those ones which are particularly difficult.
Okay. Now, that's the discussion on the first point. The next two points are US GAAP questions only. So I'll kind of take comments on them on an exception basis, if people feel. Otherwise, we'll leave it to our colleagues on the other side. Okay, Jim.
Discussion here on issue one.
Sorry, I would just echo some of the comments internationally that were mentioned, that I do think there probably will be some diversity. The write-up actually mentions or sort of implies this by saying that if there's current IFRS or US GAAP, that an entity will apply that prior guidance. So I do think different companies will have differences in applying this guidance. And so that's something you should just be aware of in this write-up in accounting.
Yeah, just to clarify, that piece is really on question two, on looking to existing GAAP. So on question one, really, it is just looking to 606. The question on the existing GAAP is more on the cost capitalization side.
Allison?
I think we agree with the staff's point that it's, I think paragraph 9 says that it's helpful to think about whether control is transferred. I think we believe that that's required part of the analysis. But where we're finding there will likely be diversity in practice is around that assessment of whether control of something transfers or not. And what we're observing is that oftentimes, just generally speaking, looking at transfer of control, people look at the control indicators and focus quite heavily on legal title and whether legal title has transferred or not. The standard is clear that there isn't, none of the factors individually are determinative, that it is a matter of judgment, but I do think that there's perhaps sometimes a bias that legal title becomes sort of the presumptive or the overriding indicator in a lot of instances. And I think that questions around customer-owned tooling, when legal title may technically transfer, sometimes that tends to lead the debate towards inferring that it should be a performance obligation when there may be other facts and circumstances that should be considered. We're also seeing other situations where legal title may not transfer, but a company is asserting that they actually have, that they should be accounting for something based on the transfer of the promise to the entity, even if legal title doesn't transfer for legal or regulatory reasons in certain jurisdictions. So I guess my point being that this discussion around transfer of control in the role that legal title plays in that analysis, we're finding to be an area of difficulty and will likely arise or result in diversity in practice, I think.
So it's a broader, it comes up more specifically in the pre-production cost, but a broader application of the control and when does it transfer.
Yes, and we have, again, taken the view that we think that it is just, transfer of legal title is just an indicator and that it isn't presumptive. And I think it would be helpful if there's TRG members or board members that would think otherwise, it would certainly be helpful for that to come out as part of the discussion. But otherwise, our thought is legal title should be evaluated with all of the other indicators of transfer of control, and there may be facts and circumstances that would indicate that just because legal title has or hasn't transferred, you know, you may come to a different conclusion with regards to whether control is actually transferred for a good or service.
Brett?
I think the struggle that we're having sort of appears to be a conflict in terms of existing U.S. GAAP in this 340.10 area, specifically the piece that talks about, you know, that Allison referenced about capitalizing the costs that I've incurred to build a tool that you own, that you, it's titled to you, which seems to suggest that I'm accounting for it still as if it's my asset. Yet I got the first analysis in this paper tells me I have to evaluate whether in fact try to transfer something to the customer, which might suggest that it's a part of my performance obligations in some cases. So it seems like it's hard to make those two things coexist, where I can both treat it as a performance obligation, record the revenue, and then capitalize the cost for tooling that, not my tooling, but someone else's, that someone else owns. So, you know, I could read that to say, well, in those situations, what I'm telling you is ignore the revenue standard, because since you're using the tooling under the customer's discretion, and as long as you're producing the parts, then it's your tooling, in effect, as I could read it that way. But it just seems hard to make those two bits sort of work together. And while the other elements of 340.10 that relate to sort of setting the bar for when you capitalize costs of A, your own tooling, more like PP&E, and that's probably pretty obvious, but NRE, that's a non-recurring engineering cost that might otherwise be expensed, the standard, that's that guidance that comes out of that old EITF provides you a framework to set up an asset that arguably is a higher bar than in the revenue standard, and that's fine. I mean, that you can sort of see how both those can work together, but it just seems like it's just really hard to put the pieces together when I've got one piece of GAAP telling me that I have to capitalize these costs in certain scenarios, even though they relate to tooling owned by somebody else. And then another piece of GAAP telling me to go ahead and treat that as a performance obligation. So it seems like we need to resolve that conflict one way or another.
Brett, just a question. So when you, in your comment, you said a couple of times, you know, the tooling owned by somebody else, and I think it links well back to Allison's point on they have the legal title, but you have to think about under 606 whether control of that actually transfers, and whether you determine, you know, if control has transferred despite if there's legal title, that might influence how you do that accounting. There's not necessarily a presumption that because legal title has transferred that control has transferred.
But we can try and capture that here. I think part of your point might be we had a guidance that was written in an era that was pre-control, and did we update the cost guidance to make clear that we were not necessarily talking about transfer of title anymore, we're talking about control.
I think Mary, we can try and do that
in the, you know, the minutes process. I guess you could ask whether that's, you know, like a technical amendment or something like that.
In certain scenarios, it seems like I have transferred control, even though I still am using it. The title does sit with the OEM, let's say, and it might be a short-term supply arrangement where their every intention is to pick it up when the project's done and reuse it. It may be protective, it may be some other reasons why they're doing it, but you know, I think the notion about transferring control, you know, in fact, title has transferred, and so in certain scenarios, it just seems like there's a direct conflict there.
So I thought the paper was helpful. One of the things that we were struggling with, we had a lot of discussions about NRE and pre-production type costs. One of the things we were struggling with is how do you think about an arrangement where you're designing a customized piece of equipment and you're going to deliver a number of units, and it's highly customized, but yet the technical specifications or the specific design deliverable doesn't really transfer, and how to think about whether you should be recognizing revenue during the pre-production NRE period. And so I thought the paper was helpful from that perspective to think about, well, does the technical specs, does the design activities is it really producing something that's going to be delivered other than the units themselves? So from my perspective, I thought that was helpful. It's interesting, though, because sometimes that design activity could be the very thing that's causing this arrangement to be accounted for as a single performance obligation, and to not think about that activity as being something that's transferring control over time if it's being accounted for as a single performance obligation is a little bit strange, but I think I get it. At least it's helpful to kind of move us in one direction or the other. On the other point about the inconsistencies with the tooling and title transfer, did we think about taking 340.10 out of, did we think about maybe eliminating 340.10 altogether? Because it is an inconsistent piece of literature. I know this isn't cost guidance, but we did eliminate a lot of other cost guidance in 81.1. So why did we leave 340.10 in? Just a question.
Personally, I think that's a fair point. It seemed like at the time of the revenue project, the board was not focused on making improvements on the cost side, merely focusing on the revenue side. But they were aware of the fact that through some of the changes made in the revenue standard that there would be some gaps in cost accounting. And so 340.40 fills the hole. But I agree with you. I can see someone looking at 10 and then looking at 40 and saying, well, why?
There are a lot of inconsistencies in the two. The thresholds are different.
Yes.
And I think that's what's creating most of the confusion.
Yeah.
Brian?
I guess one observation, Ross and folks, on that point. We just had a discussion a while ago about master supply agreements with optional purchases, and we concluded, well, you know, each purchase order would be the contract, right? And so I think of that contract that we've now been very, you know, kind of precise in GAAP and applying the principles in this revenue standard about what the boundaries of the contract are, which might be, you know, build these parts that I need for the next 2 weeks. So if you think in those terms, then this 340.10 with its notion of long, you know, undefined notion of long-term supply agreement, it's not long-term supply agreement under the revenue standard. So I guess to your point, I almost wonder whether 340.10 is in essence in many fact patterns been orphaned, in that it's not a, you know, look at from a revenue standard with the rigor of the revenue standard, it's not a long-term supply agreement. It's a purchase order for the next 2 weeks, and that's it. So I guess I'm wondering whether, you know, looked at from that perspective, whether that might be helpful to some people.
Yeah, I'm not going to, I agree that this is going to be judgment, and it's going to require, I think you've laid out some factors here that if the good ever does transfer, then it's going to be performance obligation, and if you're doing non-recurring engineering, that you give enough, I guess, reports or progress that they don't have to necessarily re-perform all the what's going on. That'll be a performance obligation, and everything else is sort of going to fall out is not. I think in the paper that was submitted, and someone had sent it to me, that they did also talk about the reimbursements that you get for this, and whether or not those should be shown as offsets to some of these costs that aren't performance obligations or not. And I assume what this is saying is that if they're performance obligations, then this is clearly revenue. But if it's not a performance obligation, are we suggesting that reimbursements for that could still be offsets or not? I think today some people believe some of those reimbursements are not in the scope of 605, but now they're part of a contract with the customer. So I just wonder what the staff's view is on the reimbursements for these and why that wasn't addressed in this paper.
Yeah. So the submission was focused on whether the pre-production is a performance obligation or just a cost under 340.10. We didn't have the submission didn't include a question on the payments, but I think on your first point, if you determine that it is a promise good or service, that payment would be related to revenue, and you'd have to figure out you allocate and treat it as part of the transaction price. If it's not, I think you'd have to look at what does that payment relate to? Some things to think about might be kind of linking back to the first question. Is your contract for pre-production and units, or pre-production with the material right for the units? You might think about that differently than if you have a contract just for the pre-production. So I don't think there's a black and white answer, but I think you have to look at what that payment relates to and make a determination how you treat it. So, but it wouldn't be part of the transaction price for if it's just pre-production.
One of the things, I mean, if there's a practice out there of making payments to your supplier, but the supplier not recognizing those as revenue today, sort of the basis for that would be useful to understand. So you're buying goods or services and you're getting cash for that, but you're recording it as an offset of your costs. Just a little bit of the basis today of how people get there would help understand, maybe whether or not the new standard changes that.
My understanding is the basis is that it's not revenue. It's not the scope of 605, but I think it.
But you're making a payment to somebody items. For revenue items.
I don't think they're revenue items. Yeah.
Scott? I'll stick with issue one for the moment. I think the paper sets forth the right principles. It is judgmental. There is, I think, going to be a lot of difficult analysis here. I think perhaps the helpful thing to mention for U.S. GAAP practitioners is that when you're trying to assess whether your tooling activity or your NRE delivers something to the customer, don't look to 340.10. That's cost guidance. Even though it's written, the words have some revenue-ish guidance there. And part of that is because the auto industry, the auto suppliers, do not believe they are in the business of selling tooling. Even if they have a contract to sell tooling, they do not believe they are in the business of selling tooling. And 99.5 was written largely with that industry in mind. So it was kind of accepted that those aren't revenue elements, and that's why I think it's written that way, having written the issue paper. I think that the important thing for U.S. GAAP practitioners is that when answering this first question, don't look to 340.10, even if it sounds like it has relevant guidance, it doesn't.
Others here? Oh, Allison.
And just, Jim, just quickly to follow up on your point, I've heard similar to Mark the point about accounting for reimbursements not as part of revenue. Just an additional argument that I've heard is because the 340.10 guidance would suggest that in order to be eligible to capitalize, you need to be expecting a direct reimbursement from your customer. So I think that there's a correlation that companies see in terms of, well, the guidance here is telling us to capitalize because we have the ability to get direct reimbursement for these costs. And so I think that they view the cash inflows that are providing that direct reimbursement as being an offset to the expense. And there are some other areas in GAAP where we do see offsetting of expenses from time to time. So just trying to provide an additional piece of information.
Struggling now, sort of general model for everything, how that would be any different if a service provider said, you'll reimburse me for travel, I guess still billed to your customer. Is there a practice of the net billing line item getting allocated to various expense categories before coming up with margin? And I would have thought likely no. But.
And absolutely appreciate that point, and I think there's a debate, but just to make clear that I think that has been existing practice, and that's some of the arguments that have been around for quite some time.
Others here?
Mary issue?
Yep, so we'll move on to questions 2 and 3. So the next two questions relate to the interaction of new cost guidance to pre-existing gap. The questions on capitalization of costs are applicable regardless of whether or not an entity determines that the pre-production activities are promised goods or services, because the determination of when to recognize revenue is a separate assessment from whether costs are expensed or capitalized. On question 2, subtopic 340.10 provides guidance on accounting for pre-production costs that relate to long-term supply arrangements. That subtopic includes guidance on capitalizing versus expensing pre-production costs. The new revenue standard did not amend the guidance on pre-production costs in subtopic 340.10. Because the guidance in subtopic 340.10 did not change as a result of the new revenue standard, and the guidance is specifically listed in the scope exception in the new cost guidance, an entity that is following the guidance in 340.10 appropriately today to determine whether costs should be capitalized or expensed would continue to do so after implementation of the new revenue standard. Question number 3 relates to accounting for pre-production costs for contracts that were previously accounted for under subtopic 605.35, revenue recognition, construction type, and production type contracts, which was superseded by the new revenue standard, and whether accounting for those costs are in the scope of the new cost guidance in subtopic 340.40, or in the scope of cost guidance in existing gap in subtopic 340.10. The basis for conclusions of the new revenue standard explains that the new cost guidance in subtopic 340.40 is intended to fill the gap arising from the withdrawal of previous gap, including previous guidance on accounting for construction contracts. Therefore, the staff thinks that those costs related to contracts appropriately accounted for in the scope of subtopic 605.35 today should be accounted for in accordance with the new guidance in subtopic 340.40 when applying update 2014-09. So with that, I'll open it up for discussion on issues 2 and 3.
Allison?
Thanks. There have already been some comments about 340.10, so I won't repeat any of those. But just thinking about on issue 3, what occurred to me is a question that I'm hearing in practice arise right now around mobilization costs. And I know that there was a reference to that overseas as we were discussing issue 1. And my understanding is that today there's mixed practice around the accounting for mobilization costs, whether they are thought of perhaps in the engineering and construction industry under 605.35, they may very well be thought of as pre-production costs or pre-contract costs, and that certainly under certain types of measures of progress, my understanding is that some entities are actually thinking of those as being part of their estimates to complete and recognizing revenue accordingly. So a question had come up as to whether, okay, if these truly are things that are happening before you actually start to build the asset that you've promised to the customer, should those be thought of as something that you ought to capitalize as a fulfillment cost, or are they still part of the performance obligation, meaning that you would, under a cost-to-cost method, attribute revenue to them? Contrast that with perhaps in the oil and gas industry, where there's, I think, some differing views about the cost that it takes to move people to be working on a platform, for example, that I don't think there is a view that those mobilization-type costs that you attribute revenue to the time spent actually getting those activities in the personnel in place to be able to actually perform under the arrangement. So as I thought about, okay, we have differences in practice today, how will that survive under the new standard? It seems to me that perhaps there really isn't, and mobilization costs is a bit of a broad term, that it is going to come down to differences in judgment in terms of does somebody really think that the activities that they're undertaking really are part of transferring the good or service to the customer? I could see in some fact patterns where somebody is saying that we do have to set up temporary facilities at a location before we can actually build a power plant. It's contractually specified in the arrangement. The customer is specifically paying us for the service, that someone could conclude that perhaps that is part of transferring the good or service. You're not actually starting to build the power plant yet, but it is part of the activity of performing under the arrangement. I could potentially see facts and circumstances that might allow you to think about them that way, which would mean they're not fulfillment costs. They are just costs to complete the performance, satisfy the performance obligation, versus I could certainly see other situations where somebody might be calling something a mobilization cost, and that mobilization cost truly is something that isn't part of satisfying the performance obligation, and that you would have to apply 340-40. So I just wanted to make the staff aware that there's questions around mobilization costs, but I do think it ultimately will come down to facts and circumstances.
And I think a key distinction there is, as you point out, the term is used quite broadly. Before you even get to the question of identifying performance obligations, you'd want to look to, you know, is that, are those mobilization costs part of a, you've already entered into the contract and you're obligated to perform them versus something that you're performing in advance in anticipation of having a contract before you even have any enforceable rights. So that might be kind of a precursor to that analysis.
On question two, I think that the staff's answer is certainly the right one. I suspect there are some companies that will wish that wasn't the answer because the capitalization threshold in 340.10 seems higher in certain circumstances than the capitalization threshold in 340.40, so some might wish that they could jump over. But I think the staff's answer is correct. The staff answer to question three, I find a little bit odd. It's easy to apply that answer today, but what about the contract that gets entered into 15 years from now? In order to figure out whether you're in the scope of 340.10 or 340.40, you have to think about whether you would have been in the scope of 605.35 15 years before, which you might have been in middle school when that applied. So I find the answer to question three to be fine in the short term and meaningless in the long term. I don't know what to do once we get out a few years. My solution to both the angst some will feel about being stuck in 340.10 and how you would do this analysis years later is delete 340.10. It was written for a specific purpose at a time when we didn't have other guidance. And I think the reason why 340.10 was written was because everybody acknowledged that normally you wouldn't capitalize these costs, but gee, what if you have some level of promise of being reimbursed? And frankly, I think the threshold in 340.10 is receivable. I don't think the asset is anything other than a receivable, even though that isn't what it normally gets called. So I actually think we would lose nothing by deleting 340.10, and we would eliminate the need to ask questions 2 and 3.
I think that's a fair assessment. I think it addresses the concerns I think both you and Brett had earlier, too. There seems to be some revenue type think in there. You have to ignore that. It sort of feels like look to revenue first, even though the words here might be written a little awkwardly after 606, you know, compared to 606. Why do we need two thresholds? At the risk of other board members saying terrible idea, I actually wonder if it's not a bad EITF issue, since the guy either a tech correction if we thought it was that level or a bad EITF issue. But others may disagree. At least one board member gave me a thumbs up, so I guess.
Deleting something without adding anything else sounds like simplification. I'm just saying.
More simplification is not well received.
And I think that has exhausted topic two.
And three? Topic two, yeah. Okay, so I think on issue one, we had sort of broad agreement that the guidance was good, but a concession that there's going to be a lot of need for judgment in those issues. It's hard for me to comment on questions two and three, except that I'm glad we've got principle-based standards as a general comment. But I guess you came to your conclusion over there, Jim, and it's you're going to delete 340.10, am I correct?
Well, I don't know if we have that. I don't know. I think that might be the consensus advice.
Okay. All right. Well, I think if we leave it there, we have a break for till 5 to 3, quarter of an hour break, and get back on to issue 3.
Sounds good.